One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Red Men Weekly podcast. Steve Hoare here, bringing you some of the best clips from all of our Red Men Plus content from the last week. As always, just letting you guys know, every show you're about to hear a clip from is available in full, either in video format on redmenplus.com, or you can get it into your native podcasting app as well. Simply head on over to redmenplus.com and sign up. If you do so as a yearly club captain, and use the code YEAR on the payment screen, Y-E-A-R. Instead of paying £50 for the season, or for the year rather, you'll pay just £25. So 12 months at 25 quid, absolute bargain. Even my maths just says that's a little bit over £2 a month for hours and hours and hours of content each and every week. It's an absolute bargain. Go and get yourselves involved. Right then, speaking of Red Men Plus, the first show I'm going to bring you from there today is the Final Word show. Yes, Liverpool beat Leicester City 3-0 at the King Power Stadium. Steve Plunkett hosted Ian Young and myself to have a big old chat about Leicester 0, Liverpool 3.
Where is the ceiling for this guy? This is a good segue to talk about the Scousers in the team. Both of them have got ridiculously high ceilings. We really don't know where Curtis Jones' career ends up. So if self-confidence is a measure of that, he's going to be a worldie. I mean, that's a bold statement, but no one else is going to do it for him. He has to find that from within himself, and he's got that in abundance. With regards to Trent, I've seen a lot of centre midfielders across Liverpool over the years. It's just different to what we've had before. He's controlling games of football. He's involved in absolutely everything. That leads me to the point you said about, he's not overthinking things. He's relaxed. He's in the game. He is constantly involved in everything Liverpool do, everything. I suspect if Thiago was playing, Thiago would be looking to give the ball to Trent because of what he's doing at the moment. What a reference that is. What a glowing endorsement that is, that the whole team is looking for you. You are a right back who's kind of stepped back into a position you grew up playing in as a kid. So it's not completely alien to him. But he's running games of football, Ian, and he's only going to get better. The question in the studio last night was, Gareth Southgate was at the game. What does he do with him? Because he's miles down the list in terms of getting in as a right back. Jamie Carragher made the point, stop thinking of him as a right back. Because beyond Rice and Bellingham, England aren't full of centre midfielders. Well, now we've got one that I would say is as good as anything I've seen from them in recent weeks.
When Trent had his best seasons at right back, he was running it. He could run a game from right back. He'd grab the game by the scruff of the neck and he'd get a game going. So it's no surprise to me that he's doing that from the centre midfield. It is no surprise to me whatsoever. I was one of the ones when people were saying, should we put Trent in midfield? The system we were playing before this one, he'd have to defend more than what he would if he was playing right back. In this system, he doesn't need to defend as much as what he would have had to if he'd have played that role as a proper sitting defensive midfielder. So, like Steve said before, we're getting the best out of him now. If Gareth Southgate can find a system where that works, then he walks into that. He should walk that England team anyway. I'm sorry, he should.
He should, but I still don't think he's a midfielder. I don't think you just play him in a three-man midfield. I think the fact that it is this role where he can do anything. If you put him in midfield, he's kind of inhibited. He has to fill a role. In this role, he doesn't. He can go where he wants. Because if he goes over, if he goes to the left, well, he's got Henderson over there, and everyone knows. If he's just starting in a midfield, a 2-3, he has to be there all the time. What Liverpool have done, they've built a system where I'm trying to think the right phrase. Like, it doesn't matter where he is.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we press, we work hard.
And they've built it for him, haven't they?
Yeah, and it's perfect. That's exactly what they've done. Liverpool have changed. They've changed the lad jobs of 10 different fellas to make Trent, to make Trent shine. But by making Trent shine, it makes Jones shine, it makes Gakpo shine, it makes Salah shine, he gets more of the ball. Kanate has got, rather than being pinned up against centre-half, he's got all that freedom to use his big athletic gifts that he's got
and he can use his pace, and it's almost making everyone look a bit better. And that's what it just. I don't think I would ever say go and just start Trent as a centre mid, because maybe in a 4-2-3-1 if he's next to Fabinho, perhaps, but then he has only then got one in front of him. Yeah. He hasn't got the two lads doing all his running. So all that running that Curtis Jones and Henderson are doing, he'd be doing that. So he wouldn't be getting the ball as often, because he'd be the one having to chase shadows and get the press going. But what happens is, what works really well is that Jones and Hendo and Gakpo, they go and press, the team give it away, Fabinho gives it to Trent, and Trent's in space. That's how this all works. If Trent's the one doing all that legging about, Fabinho's like, oh, fuck. You know what I mean?
That's really interesting, because Manchester City play in a way where everything they do is to create time and space for Kevin De Bruyne to play the killer ball.
Yep.
We're doing the same thing.
Yep.
What is really interesting for me, and I take your point with England, you just couldn't put him in midfield. It was something Jamie Carragher said, and I wanted to get your opinion on it, is that currently how things are is we're now facing up teams and we're saying in front of our back three, we've got seven players. You don't know how to deal with those seven players because they're fluid, they interchange. Curtis Jones does whatever Curtis Jones feels he wants to do because he's got the remit to be brave and roam. Trent Alexander, as you quite rightly said, often appears on the left-hand side. How do you deal with that? You can't go man for man because you're pulling people all over the place. It's kind of like he's looked at what City have done with Stones, looked at what Arsenal have done with Zinchenko to a degree, and then gone, actually, my guy doing this job is a whole lot better than your two guys you're going to put in there. And that's not discrediting John Stones, who's a brilliant footballer. Let's not get that twisted. He is absolutely superb. But he can't do what Trent can do. So we're now, like Steve says, we're now building. We've looked at Trent and said, that's your man. That's your Steven Gerrard type character. That's your iconic, talismanic player that is going to be the future of this football club. He's 24 years old. He's got the intelligence to do this for 10 years. Do you know what? Let's tear it all up. Let's look differently. And I think this is interesting for me, because a lot of social media at the moment is saying, why have we stopped talking about a six? Because you don't need a six in the system. Because you've got two guys sitting there alongside each other when Trent's in midfield. So that stops the need to have one specialist number six. Fab looks really good at the moment because when he's got time and space, he can use a ball. The chip over the top for the Mane goal against Man United is evidence he can play football. This is totally built around, they are Trent, go and do your thing.
Yeah, because Trent is that good as well. He's one of them players that when he's playing well, he makes other players around him good. He makes other players better. Luis Suarez is exactly the same. How many players did he look better than they've ever looked before because of how good he was? When Trent Alexander-Arnold is on song, he makes the players around him look so much better. And that's why building a system around a player like that works and benefits the whole team and not just that one player.
So it's off the back of the third goal, Steve. We get the longest and the best rendition of Si Señor you'll ever hear in your life.
Yeah, it was class, yeah.
15 minutes, and the camera kept going to Bobby and he's smiling. Saturday's going to be a tearful one for everyone, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I hope he's fit. I think Jürgen half referenced that he probably will be. So get him on the pitch. We have to find the James Milner song maybe as well before then. I think it might be too late, but he deserves it as well. But you're right, it was that was. But Liverpool earned that by the game.
100%.
Because if that's a nervy one all, or you know, a tense one, you can't. Everyone's on edge, and that basically, I was speaking to Chloe before she was there. It was party time, and why not? It's a great song. He's a legend. He deserves it. All of it. But Liverpool's players gave Liverpool's fans the right to enjoy the last 15-20 minutes of that game without anything. No stress, no dramas. Not, you know, it's not 1-0 like it was against Fulham or Brentford or this mad Tottenham game. It was complete control. It was from like you say, from the second goal onwards, really, Liverpool were always going to win that game. Leicester had given the ghost up and you know, living to fight another day. So it was party time. It was, again, I was on the watch along, but we put a bit of sound on the TV just so we could hear it, and it was relentless. It was non-stop. It was fun. That, when you go away and you just completely own a team and just dominate them from start to finish, especially Leicester, who were horrible. It's an absolute bonus, isn't it? And it was brilliant. You're right with Firmino. He's got two games left now. I hope he can feature in both of them at some point. But yeah, you're right. It was almost tear-jerking now. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's on our YouTube. I think like over 80,000 people have already watched it. Just 2 minutes. This was at the final whistle of just him coming over to the crowd to say thank you. Imagine how he feels after that. He's not even on the pitch. And he's getting that. It's a fitting tribute to what was a wonderful
stick
player.
Him on the pitch in a kit for 90 seconds at the end of the Villa game just so he can get his plaudits is how I see that. Ian, I'll come to you on this. Is a thing that's reoccurring in recent weeks. About 70 minutes we start making changes. from that 70 minutes onwards, we lose all semblance of shape and cohesion for me. It's not working. I don't know whether that's plan B to look at that in the summer, because we're not. I don't think we're managing games particularly well. We're putting bodies on the pitch to give the players who've been there a rest. I for 70 minutes to 90 minutes, I don't remember much about the game from a footballing perspective, because I just think we lose all of our cohesion. Carvalho comes on, makes a headless chicken run into the box and gives the ball straight to the keeper with a heavy touch. Elliot comes on a few nice little bits and pieces. Milner comes on to do what Milner does, which is to talk and manage out the games. But we're not a goal threat when we make these changes for me. And if there's a small concern from recent weeks, and it's being hypercritical, because when you've won 7 games and not lost in 9, it is hypercritical. It is the next thing we need to look at for me is how we sustain a goal threat when we make the changes.
You have better players on the bench, don't you? We just didn't have that. I think the lack of Nunes yesterday, as much as his performance went a bit patchy, to say it late, I think he has a different threat when he comes on, doesn't he? So when Jota comes on, I thought Jota looked okay when he came on. I just don't think the changes were necessarily needed. I think they were just more there to give people a few minutes in the legs.
Saving legs as well. That's what it is. It's been a long season. Right then, thanks very much to Steve for hosting that one. It was nice actually being a guest on one of the shows for once. I haven't done that for a while. Right then, moving on to the Bias Football Podcast. Yeah, this week it was Paul Machin, Chris Pajak, it was Chloe Bloxham and Steve Plunkett. Yeah, sometimes it's nice to talk about other teams who aren't the Reds and have a little look what's going on elsewhere, and that's exactly what that amazing quartet did.
Let's jump back on the relegation stuff. Mentioned there, Forest got a point against Chelsea. It's weird to look at the league table, which I'll get up again. Leicester, I thought the real vibes after our game against them, Chris, the way that all the commentary team were talking about and blah, 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 everyone's got that sinking feel with Leicester. They, once we got the first goal, they completely and utterly crumbled. The fans were emptying out, all that kind of stuff, as Chloe pointed out before. Leeds, you can see a little bit of, you know, we talk about Sam Allardyce might be able to juice them up a touch. They score goals, they can see goals. They've got the worst defence in the league, Leeds, but the fact is they do score goals and he does make teams defend. Forest don't score goals and concede loads and are somehow 3 points outside the relegation zone at this point.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy.
I'm with Chloe though. I do think that the bottom three today are the bottom three at the end of the season. I actually think Everton have got enough points as it stands to stay up.
Wow.
A point outside of the relegation zone.
I don't think the others are getting any more points.
So Leeds United's final two games of the season, as mentioned, West Ham away,
yeah.
Tottenham at home.
Yeah, Harry Kane's big send-off.
And just even though we're all saying we think Leicester are down, even though there's only 2 points behind,
yeah,
they have got Newcastle on Monday Night Football,
yeah.
West Ham at home.
Yeah.
I don't know what the fuck is Liverpool? Okay, it's fine.
Singapore.
Oh, the Singapore game, right. Why the fuck are they putting that in the fixed list? Weirdo. Leicester, fuck that, aren't they? although, again, West Ham might have one eye on a potential Conference League final. That's something to think about.
Declan Rice, big send-off.
There is one thing about that. When we talked about the Man United stuff, I didn't mention that. You know, they play Fulham last game of the season, albeit at home, but that's like less than a week until the FA Cup final off the back of that. You know, there's just something. I'm Fulham, I am kicking 7 shades of shite. I'm kicking them all over Old Trafford.
100%.
Mitrovic throwing elbows on their one fit centre half would be absolutely magical. And the Ev they've got Wolves away and Bournemouth at home. Now, we've talked
about
this.
Have to win against Wolves.
We said this a week ago, 2 weeks ago. If they could get to those final two games and not be dead, then they should probably stay up. They're the fixtures you would cherry pick of the other ones down there. Let me just do Forest as well, actually. Even though I think you're right. I think Forest are probably too far. Forest have got Arsenal at home and Crystal Palace away.
Not winning them.
I don't know. I actually weirdly fancy them against Arsenal, believe it or not.
The bubble's burst with Arsenal, hasn't it? They can't be caught. They're sitting there doing their own heads in because they've got 4 points in the game in hand behind City, could win it the next game. So it could be like, fuck it,
You know what I mean? We'll just go through the motions because we're safe in second place and we feel sorry for ourselves and we'll go to Nottingham Forest and they've got something to play for and we haven't and you just never know.
Who plays first in that title race? Is it City?
City.
If City could get it done before Arsenal play, I'd appreciate it.
So City obviously got Champions League midweek. They've got Chelsea on Sunday at 4 o'clock.
For God's
and then Arsenal play Nottingham Forest on Saturday at 5:30. So, but that will make it, they'll be a point behind, but City will have two games in hand at that point. I wasn't really going to talk about the title race because it's just become so criminally boring because of Manchester City. A point I've been trying to make on this for a few weeks, the best thing that could happen to Arsenal for me, which sounds so counterintuitive, is to lose the last couple of games of the season and just have City rack up a big old lead because it restoring the status quo, I think, actually helps them a bit next season. It takes the pressure off them a little bit. Instead of you've got to bridge a 1-point gap, having to bridge an 11-point gap or whatever instead is a much better, I think, it's a less pressure-filled target.
Exactly. The media stop talking about you like you're a title challenger because they've just spent the last 6 weeks telling everybody that they're not a title challenger and it wasn't really a title race in the end. So I agree with you on that point. I think it's really a shoot point, actually. but, like, I don't know where Arsenal go from here, to be honest with you. Their performance against Newcastle I thought was brilliant. Like, we watched it in yours, didn't we? I thought they were brilliant. And then obviously getting absolutely humped at the weekend. Are there still those Arsenal insecurities in the performances? I think next season we're going to be their biggest challenger for second. I don't think they're ready for a title run yet.
I think their body language is just horrific. After everything that's came their way and not gone their way for whatever reason, any result that has not been a win, they've seen it as a negative. And yeah, okay, it is, but let the fans think that. You internally cannot think that. You've got to feed off any positivity you can get, otherwise your steam runs out. You've got to find things to keep you uplifted in a title race, because Liverpool, literally like you mentioned, lost a one game all season and didn't win the league. If we'd have mentally criticised ourselves for every single draw we'd got, and the fans did, but they're allowed to, they're outside. Yeah, but inside, as it was going on, you had to think, it's Old Trafford, it's away, okay, it's this, okay, we're still, and that's what you've got to do. There is them lying on the pitch of our 6 weeks ago after a draw, what are you doing?
Yeah.
That's sending a message to Manchester City, and it's sending a message to the rest of the Premier League.
This is know-how, and this is what, you've got to do this to get to the point where you can go to the next step, so we miss out on two big trophies by a final and 1 point. What does Klopp do? He turns around to the team and says, I need 5% more from you to get you over the line, and they deliver. Or you do what Pochettino does, which is cry at every press conference because you didn't get £300 million to spend, chuck your toys out the pram, and then you get sacked off. There's differences with this, and this is the big acid test for Arsenal. They will either gain resolve and come again and be stronger for the experiences of this year, or they'll just turn into another Pochettino. I think they've got the strength in the club to recruit properly and make themselves a bit of a force for the next 4 or 5 years. They'll be in and around it.
They're always a good draw, aren't they, Arsenal? Them being in London and having that 4 years of Champions League football. They've just got a massive fan base. Everyone respects them.
The heritage.
Always known for playing good football, kind of doing it the right way. Young, progressive manager in charge. Exciting front three, exciting team. Doing things tactically a bit different to others, they're going to be a massive draw.
They're in that awkward position of a couple of things where you're right, that experience, you've got to have that experience of getting over the line. They've got a boss 11. They're lucky in so much as there's a couple of really obviously upgradable positions. Shaka's very upgradable. The second centre half maybe is upgradable, but they're also in that struggling position where you maybe buying Trossard's probably all right because Martinelli's young and Saka's young and Jesus is young
for them at the time for a January signing where you can play across all front three positions.
But if they need more in the summer, it becomes a harder sell because where are you playing? You know what I mean? They've got a lot of that 11 established already that are good enough. But you then, are you improving your 11 or are you buying squad players? And that's where they've got to balance that. The thing they've got, I thought you really interesting point about that, you know, you just mentioned there about how their body language and reacting to it. That's just experience. Don't let them know you're upset. Yeah. I always think like, stupid example, but I remember that the older you get, the more capable you become of just dealing with disappointments and moreover not showing it. And I think about like, you look at like Instagram now, you get some of these people who are like, the young people and something goes wrong for them, like get a bad haircut and they're freaking out. I remember my mum and dad's mate going on like a BBC style challenge. It was called the style challenge. And the mum got a makeover. And at the end, you don't get to see it. And they turn the mirror around and she just went, and we watched and went, she fucking hates this. But you'd never know. Because you don't go on telly and freak out and let everyone know and embarrass yourself by letting the world know how much you hurt. No, you're old, you're experienced. You push that down inside and you take that out up when no one else is looking. And Man City are that. Man City, like, they face the disappointments and they're like, oh, yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. We'll handle this. Was Arsenal like freaking out and having panic attacks and fucking just, rolling around on the floor? You just reminded me of
that. Who's that young blonde girl who died recently, who did Big Brother years ago, Jesus freaked out Christ. In the diary room?
Jade.
No, the other one.
Nicola McLean.
No, she.
I know what you mean.
And she freaked out in the diary room about something. Oh, no,
it's I know exactly who you mean. I can see it now. Nikki Graham.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. There you go. Sometimes you just got to internalise that shit. And Arsenal are very much of the internet generation where there's value in showing everyone how upset you are. That's what it's Arsenal in a nutshell. They need to demonstrate to their fan base how upset they are. It's like how people it's like performative anger on social media. That's what Arsenal are as a club. Like why I think Oxlade-Chamberlain suffers at times, because when he makes a mistake, he doesn't just get on with it. He has to let everyone know that he's upset with the mistake that he's made, so that people know that he cares. He didn't want to fuck it up and stuff. Like, just shut up and get on with it, mate. It's fine. Arsenal, I've got that to overcome in a big time and a big way next season. Do we want to know what the percentages are this season? The 538 predictions?
Yeah, go on.
Should we start at the bottom?
Yeah.
Southampton, done. Relegated. Tick. We knew that. Leicester, 86% chance of relegation right now. Leeds United, 64%.
How is it that big of a jump?
It's wild, isn't it? Everton, 26%, and Nottingham Forest, 24%. It was all Leicester were so comfortable up until going at that game against Everton, and we said that's make or break for either side, and throwing that chance away has absolutely killed.
They could have gone 3-1 up, couldn't they, just before half time?
Dean Smith looks so far out of his comfort zone in that job. But as you look at Sam Allardyce, just rock around. Too late for me to do anything. If it goes wrong, no one cares.
On a positive note, how good is it to see John Terry looking like boiled shite at the end of the game? You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely magical. Up the top, Liverpool up to a 37% chance of Champions League.
Oh, sorry, what?
37.
It's not good enough.
Brighton down
though.
To just 2%. We've absolutely snuffed that out.
I've made
some terrible fucking bets on a 35% fucking chance of it. Like,
But I think that then jinxes it. I can't bet on footy.
I never bet on Liverpool.
I never bet on Liverpool.
Apart from stupid things, like daft things that are above and beyond, like Mo Salah being top goal scorers, and it has always been an easy one, although the money in that is diminished greatly over the years. It'll be back next season
you may as well throw the money on the floor.
Navigator 10 Premier League goals has been doing me in for 5 seasons on the bounce.
What's that, about 17,000 to 1? He doesn't even play 10 games, does he?
Newcastle and Man United both in an 81% chance, so Liverpool are very much outsiders for top 4, just the way we like it.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey.
They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thanks very much to Paul and the guys for that one. Hope you've enjoyed that. Right, next up then, Liverpool were linked with a move for Southampton midfielder Romeo Lavia earlier this week. And to get the lowdown exactly what's happening with that transfer, and is it going to happen, is it not, etc., etc., Dan Club invited Belgian journalist Sacha Tavaleri onto the show to talk all about the 19-year-old wonder kid.
And I think his age actually really suits Liverpool at the moment, because we are in need of midfield reinforcement. And like I said myself, Fabinho has been better recently, so maybe we don't need somebody to replace Fabinho, but we need somebody younger who can replace him in the future and can also give him some minutes off. And I think Stefan Bajcetic could do that a little bit next season, but I think someone like Lavia would actually make a lot of sense in that sense. You mentioned a couple of weeks ago that Liverpool made contact regarding Lavia and the interest was concrete. How far did those talks go? And in terms of Liverpool's list, because Liverpool's list of targets is quite long, how high up would you put him on that list?
I guess that as number six, he's probably the most closest to the list, because the people say, okay, it's a midfield and we are targeting a lot of midfields and midfielders, and this is something true, but at this position there is not a lot of players that can compete with him. And and Liverpool board also know him. And, you know, during the transfer window in England, there is something really clear, is that when big clubs are on a player, all the big clubs want to get him, you know. So it's a bit also a fight, a political type of fight, you know, influential type of fight. And it's making the valuation of the player also growing. And also in the mind of the board. So they say, okay, if Manchester United, Arsenal and Chelsea wants to get him or are interested in him, we should maybe give all what we have to do. So we lose the fight with Bellingham. We are fighting and we know that it will be really tough with Brighton to get McAllister. So let's give also all what we can have on that kind of player that can signify the future. What's good and what can really be the good point and the most important thing for Lavia is that he can be a priority of a new project that is building with Liverpool. Everybody knows that next year it will start something new. It's not the case on Manchester United. It's not the case at Arsenal that are continuing on a new project, but it's not, you know, there is not something that it's breaking and then we go back on something new, you know. So for Chelsea, it's a mess. No one wants to go in Chelsea. I spoke with international players. They say, I will never go to Chelsea because there is no visibility on the project. So I guess Liverpool is the most clear project for the moment for Lavia. And that's why, for me, they are number one.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Liverpool have actually had a lot of success in the transfer market buying players who have been recently relegated, Andy Robertson, Gini Wijnaldum in the past. How high, you've spoken, so you give a lot of praise to Lavia, how high do you think his ceiling is? You mentioned he's already played for Belgium, he's only 19, he's played a lot in the Premier League. How good can this player be? And also, in terms of a Jurgen Klopp side and this current Liverpool team, is he a good fit for what we're trying to do?
Yes, what's really interesting in him, and you can really remark it when you see his type of play and his type of game, surely on the pitch, is that he's directly giving the ball forward, you know. So he's not thinking about, okay, let's take the ball, passing to my defender or passing to someone who is at the same level, the same position as me. No, He directly think about how to go straight to the goal. And this is really the club mentality. And that's also why Klopp really loves him, because he's able to make a proper work. He's not a butcher, you know. He's someone who really wants to make the things as the most proper possible. But he's always thinking about how the game can be more far now with me. And this is also the fact and the way Liverpool's old staff and Klopp loves him. He loves him because he thinks that there doesn't exist. I didn't see other type of players than Romeo Lavia in that register in Premier League. Being really proper, giving the ball quickly forward, and playing on the side of the game and on the philosophy of the game of Liverpool. So being the more offensive and the more quick as possible, straight away to the goal. And that's why I guess he's, for me, the perfect profile as defensive midfielder for the Reds.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been really impressed with what I've seen, especially, like I said earlier, in a team that has struggled so much. It can be hard for someone so young in a team that is essentially getting beat almost every week. They haven't picked up a lot of points, but he has been one bright spark from their season. And like you said earlier, it does feel as though he will remain in the Premier League. If anything, he should be looking to take a step up the Premier League, not drop to the Championship. So it's an interesting one. And just finally, Sasha, you've already said he will leave Southampton this summer. That's pretty much inevitable. As things stand, you've mentioned a minute ago that Liverpool are sort of number one in the race. Where do you think he will end up after this summer?
I'm not Mrs. Irma, you know. I'm not giving the future, but I can guess that it could be at 60% Liverpool, because we don't know for the moment. There is no, and it's important also to signify it, because it's not buzzing for making buzz. You know, it's always telling to people what's going on now. There hasn't been any offer from Liverpool for the moment, so everyone is really And it's important also to know it for the moment. We are speaking about the seducing part of the transfer window. It's really the seducing moment when everyone knows a bit where they want to go, what they want to do, and they are preparing a bit all the weapons to go, of course, for July. So for the moment, no offers from Liverpool, that's a certitude, but the project is the one who is most convening to Lavia, and also, and that's why I think it will be Liverpool. It's also the way for Southampton to get a lot of money. We know that the relation between Southampton and Liverpool is really, really good. Before there has been deals between the two clubs, and they are used to make a lot of relation during the transfer windows. We can speak about Mané, but there are other cases. Yeah. There is not an exception. Mané is not an exception. They are used to speak together during the transfer window. Mm-hmm. So for me, Liverpool could be the best choice for the player, and could be also the best opportunity for selling them at the highest price for Southampton. So let's say 60% Liverpool.
Yeah, I'll take that. And I hope you're right as well, because you are right. Liverpool have done a lot of business with Southampton down the years. You mentioned one there, but there's Adam Lallana, Dejan Lovren. We've done a lot. Vicky Lambert previously as well. We've done a lot of business with them. So it's a fascinating one to watch. I hope Liverpool are an attractive proposition for someone like Lavia, because as you say, very young, very talented, the type of player we should probably be looking at, and hopefully something does happen there.
Cheers, Dan. Cheers, Sasha, for that one. You had a very exciting player. Is he going to end up at Liverpool? We'll find out in due course. Right then, speaking of players who may or may not, hopefully may, end up as Liverpool players, it's time for a clip from JNO Insight. Just the day before I had Neil into the show, he done me a big old favour by writing an article on goal.com all about Alexis McAllister, saying that the Brighton midfielder is keen on a move to Merseyside. Well, absolute bonus for me, because that wrote half my agenda for the show. So yeah, here's me asking Neil Jones about the Argentinian World Cup winner. Let's talk transfers then. And like I said this off before as well, Neil boxed me off by putting this story up yesterday, so I can ask him about it. If you head over to goal.com, you'll see Neil wrote yesterday. It's a big piece about Liverpool, Brighton midfielders, Liverpool won Alexis McAllister, but Moises Caicedo was the Brighton midfielder who would really transform Jurgen Klopp's side. I'll speak to you, that opinion part of it in a second, but I think the thing that people started tweeting me, and I got about 20 messages to ask you about this from various people. The Discord went wild, including Josh Hall, who, happy birthday to Josh, by the way, it's his birthday today.
Is it, yeah? Piano Insight legend.
Yeah, happy birthday to Josh. Loads of these messages. Anyway, when you said that it's understood that Alexis McAllister's keen on a move to Merseyside, because that came not long, because there was reports from The Athletic, it was Bright, who were saying he's keen on Champions League footy, and I suppose you put a lot of smile on people's faces, really, with that one, because that was kind of... No, I don't think anyone else actually wrote that anywhere, really. There's been lots of reporting, Neil, about Liverpool wanting him, but it was, does he fancy Liverpool? But it seems to feel like... you've written now that you believe that he is.
Yeah, he is. I mean...
Please carry on, Mark, that can't be the end of
it. Well, I mean, it can be... I mean, it can be both, can't it? I mean, Champions League football is still on the agenda as well, but I think if you listen to Jürgen last week... He said, I don't get in front of players much, which, okay, we'll see. But he said, when I do, I very rarely get a player saying to me, yeah, I'm keen as mustard, but by the way, you have to be in the Champions League, you know. And he's made that comment before about pushing the train and being part of the journey and all those kind of things. But Liverpool would not be having him on their list of targets if Alexis McAllister only wanted to join a Champions League club. It's just, they would not do it. They would, that would be the first thing. It would actually, they would actually withdraw from the race themselves if that was the case, because they would say, well, all right then, see you later. That's the way they operate. You know, it would not have got to the stage where, right, we're in the race for him. So, and his father was obviously at a game earlier this season. I think there's obviously, it's not just a desire to play Champions League football, it's a desire to play for a Champions League club. And Liverpool, even if they're not in the Champions League next season, they are a Champions League club, level club. So that possibility is definitely up there. I think the biggest question is the money, is around, you know, what's he going to cost? There was a story, obviously, about 70 million at the weekend. I spoke to people at Liverpool who were like, well, it's not really agreed. You know, that's not really a figure that's sort of been ironed out. Brighton in a position where, again, we spoke about it a few times, they don't necessarily have to sell. I think there was a story from David Ornstein about a mechanism as opposed to a clause that may be able to help get McAllister out of Brighton in the summer, but not necessarily one where it's like, right, you pay that much and he's gone. I think so. It's going to be difficult to get anyone out of Brighton. And I think it comes down to what's the overall package going to cost. You know, if you're talking sort of £100 million for Alexis McAllister, I don't think Liverpool are there. I don't think anyone's there personally. So what can you get him for? You know, is it closer to sort of 60, 65 million? I think Liverpool would be there. But I think there's going to be developments on that in the next few weeks. Definitely, well, of course, there is going to be developments on it in the next few weeks. But I think this sort of by the end of this month, I think we'll be in a pretty clear position of where he's going and how sort of close Liverpool are to getting this deal done. But I think he is a player that's right at the top of Liverpool's list now in terms of it, and I can see why. I know we'll come on to talk about the piece yesterday, which is my belief. That's just an opinion, that headline of mine. But I can see also why Liverpool would want McAllister, because he keeps the ball well. He scores goals, he creates goals, he's set-piece excellent. He's a player who's used to winning, and he's a player who's used to having a lot of the ball, a lot of pressure around it, and also used to playing in a team that's sort of on the front foot an awful lot as well. So I think he would be a good fit, definitely.
I suppose you also like to hear that Jurgen Klopp is believed to have received a glowing feedback on his character and training habits from Adam Lallana.
Yeah.
Obviously, who Jurgen knows well, obviously. First of all, Jurgen's not having those conversations. I mean, there's the red light that they're interested in him. Why is Jurgen phoning Adam Lallana up for, or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, that could be incidental conversations in the sense of, you know, yeah, I think Jurgen speaks to Adam Lallana a lot, just generally, and you know, that could be just passed on as, oh, this McAllister's a great, great lad, you know, whatever. But yeah, that reference will not go on those. As, you know, that, I think that's worth more than a sort of, almost worth more than a scout's report on, you know, oh, he had a good game against Manchester United, or he was brilliant against Arsenal on Sunday. You know, that's the kind of stuff that he wants to know. You know, what's he like in training? I don't know what the feedback necessarily is off Caicedo, potentially. You know, I know he had a little bit of a set two at the club, didn't he, towards the back end, and he was told to stay away. Whether that counts against him in any kind of sort of character reference, possibly not. I mean, Virgil van Dijk had something similar, didn't he, I think, at Southampton, where, you know, it didn't put Liverpool off signing him. But yeah, I think Jürgen values someone like Lallana, who knows the Liverpool character. You know, if Adam Lallana said, oh, he could play in that Liverpool squad, he'd fit in. I think it's worth its weight in gold, isn't it? Yeah. You know, for someone like Liverpool. And I believe, not necessarily that's exactly what's been said, but I think that's the sort of tone that's been said, that, you know, if you're wavering on McAllister, I'd say yes, he can go and play for this team, never mind in terms of his ability, but in terms of his character as well. You know, he would enhance your squad and your personality within the squad. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to work that out, does it? He's gone into the Argentina side and made them a much sort of more coherent and closer team, and he's obviously very popular among that. He's had a big impact at Brighton. I believe, you know, his English has come on well. I think his girlfriend was a fluent English speaker when he came over, and now he's sort of in that position as well. So I think it's there's a lot of positives around McAllister as a player, as a person, and as a potential signing.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to end on this one for now, and then we'll talk about the Caicedo stuff, which is your opinion part of it. But you say McAllister's the one they want, and he's the one they think they can get. Even like, so it sounds like there's a bit of confidence around this one. Is like, for example, when we've sat here in the past about Bellingham or Tchouaméni, it's been the hopeful, or, you know, yeah. But this one, do you think they can get him? Is that a different tone compared to those two deals, perhaps? Or
possibly, might be too much into that? Possibly. I mean, he's not as big name a player, is he? Yeah. You know, albeit he's a World Cup winner and he's a very good player, but he's not. I don't think you're talking about competing against Real Madrid and Manchester City for Alexis McAllister, for example. So that instantly sort of knocks a layer off in terms of your confidence, you know, in terms of whether you think you can get him. That I think the money, the fact he's coming from a club like Brighton is more in line with Liverpool's recruitment policy anyway, isn't he? You know, in terms of he's coming from a certain level and he sees Liverpool as that step up, yeah, as opposed to, listen, Bellingham would see Liverpool as a step up, but when you've got Real Madrid and you've got Manchester City, you know, there's a few step-ups you can take. There's going to be a lot of midfielders moving this summer, isn't there? Clearly, the story is already coming, you know, gathering pace around Arsenal, Declan Rice. The story is going to develop about Bellingham. I think, you know, there'll be other players, Caicedo, another one, that there's going to be a bit of a merry-go-round, I think, of midfielders. Mason Mount, obviously, another one that we've spoken about a lot on this show. I think there's a lot of potential sort of jigsaw pieces that can fall into place, and it might depend on who goes where for what, in terms of money that gets talked about. We're looking at Brighton. I mean, there's another part of the story there is Brighton. You can see they're already starting to spend money for next season. Mo Dahoud is going to come in on a free. Milner, Xhao Pedro's come in as a sort of a forward, you know, attack-minded forward. I look at the players that they're starting to feed into the side now in Ciso and Buonanotte, and you're thinking, yeah, they might have found another couple, certainly within Ciso. They bought a guy, a Swedish international in January, who hasn't really played he hasn't yet played. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see him in the next couple of games, just to give him a bit of a feed into the team. So it's not a case of Brighton are going to be left high and dry and, oh, what are we going to do for next season? You know, they're already starting to make preparations, I think, for McAllister and or Caicedo leaving. The manager spoke about it after the Arsenal game, which, by the way, some performance, wasn't it? We're all talking about Manchester City's performance against Real Madrid, and it was fantastic. That Brighton performance at Arsenal on Sunday was something that I think made a lot of people go, wow, that was a serious
job.
Yeah, you can't argue. You look at it and you think, that is identity, isn't it? That is identity in a team from a manager. And as a result of that, you know, the players within that are going to get a lot of plaudits. But afterwards, he said, didn't he, for sure we're going to lose some players. Maybe McAllister, maybe Caicedo. I think he name-checked Matoma and Estupiñán. I think it was those two. As sort of, they might need a little bit longer before they're in that position, which is interesting. You know, I probably would say Matoma looks ready for the move this summer. You know,
I don't know if you've seen the video of him where a young kid at a Brighton fan event asks him like about Matoma, and he goes, "You can get his name on the back of your shirt next year," or something along those lines.
Like, yeah, I haven't seen that.
He says something like, he says, "Do you get what I mean?" As it basically,
yeah, he's going nowhere. Yeah, I mean, listen, he's a breakthrough star this season, isn't he? So potentially, if you were going to spend a big chunk of money on him, you might want to see a little bit more from him and be sure that it's not just a hot streak. But wow, what a player he looks like. You know, Ben White will be having nightmares, I think, for a few weeks about what he experienced at his hands or his feet on Sunday. But De Zerbi name-checked these two players, didn't he? In particular, McAllister and Caicedo. I think there's an acceptance at Brighton that probably someone's going to cough up the money that they want. The players are probably going to want to leave, definitely going to want to leave, I think. And there'll be some handshakes and thank you for everything. Go and enjoy the rest of your career.
So watch the space on Alexis McAllister. It sounds like, I think the general report was, he wants to get to the end of the season, he owes Brighton that. They're playing for a lot. They're not out this top four race, and they're very much in the European place race for this Europa League, if not conference thing. So it feels like this one could be one that moves quickly, but it'll wait until the end of the season.
Perhaps. Yeah. I mean, I think that's been the general, I think Fabrizio Romano reported that like he wants to get the move done quickly. He wants to get his future decided quickly once the season's over. So, you know, what, we've got 10 days before the season's over. As I say, I don't think by the end of May we'll be in much doubt as to, at the very least, that he's going to leave Brighton, and potentially even as well where he's going to end up.
Is it United? I've seen United links
for McAllister. I think Chelsea as well. I've been linked. Yeah. I mean, Chelsea got a lot of midfield work to do, haven't he? You know, you think of, you've got Kovacic in the last year, you've got Kante as it stands out of contract, you've got Mount, Gallagher, Loftus-Cheek. There's a lot of midfielders at Chelsea who there's a question mark around. It's probably only Enzo Fernandez, isn't it, of the sort of the first team clutch that you say, well, yeah, he's definitely going to be part of Chelsea's midfield next season. I mean, there's a midfielder in the dugout in terms of, we don't know, you know, he's obviously in Frank Lampard, that's going to end up sort of away from the club. So there's a lot of change coming at Chelsea. Of course, they're going to be linked with a lot of players. I think McAllister was one that was linked in January, maybe just on the back of the World Cup, potentially. But I think they'd certainly see him. I mean, if you had Enzo Fernandez and Alexis McAllister, you've got Argentina's midfield, really, haven't you? You know, you're only missing Messi. And he's available, yeah, I believe, this summer. Yeah. So
don't give Tom Bowley any ideas. That isn't beyond the realms. Thanks very much to Neil for coming in again. And yeah, like I say, absolute Brucey bonus that he put that story out just like a day before. Done me a big old favour. Indeed, made that show a rather simple one to plan. Right then, finally, let's talk deep dive. Let's look at stats. Let's look at tactics. Let's look at analytics and all that good stuff with two of the best in the business, Mr. Chris Pajak and Mr. Josh Williams at Distance Covered. Yeah, let's check out this week's episode of The Deep Dive.
And today we are going to be discussing the WM formation, a little bit about its history, where it came from, moving through the years, and looking at some of the teams that have used the WM formation in possession over the last sort of 10 years, of which there are quite a few, to be honest with you, which I missed at the time. Done my research now, though, Josh, and I suppose the first thing, let's explain it for anybody who didn't watch the YouTube show. Why is it called the WM formation? I suppose I better put them into it.
Yeah. Do you want me to explain it all?
Yeah, go on, mate.
Yeah, well, it's basically because of the shapes that they form on the pitch. So you've got your attacking bank of five forming a W, and you've got your defensive bank of five forming an M.
So
there
we go. The points of which, the W and an M.
Yeah. Standard tactical variety, and there's lots of different ways of doing it, lots of different variations which we're going to touch on. It does go way, way back, and yeah, we're going to go into it now.
Yeah, so Herbert Chapman is sort of regarded as the godfather of the WM formation. He won an FA Cup and two league titles with Arsenal, started using it in like the mid-1920s because of a change in the offside law, and then funnily enough, randomly, Patrick Vieira in 2016 started using it for New York City FC. Now, I'm right in saying, aren't I, just that Patrick Vieira was a coach at Manchester City.
Yeah.
Was there any... When did Pep get there? Was it 2017? Was he a year after Klopp? There'd be no crossover there, would there?
I think there was maybe a slight crossover. I think 2016 onwards is when Pep got there. So Pep's first season was 16-17.
So there may be a touch of
maybe
a crossover
maybe
there.
Maybe a little one, yeah, but I don't think enough to influence this.
Interesting, actually. So we got another a couple of one. This heavily influenced what is called the Catenaccio in Italian football, which was used for a couple of decades, really. And the shape was slightly different in that in this formation, you had your two, your three, and your two over there.
Do you know what Catenaccio stands for?
I've got no fucking idea, mate.
It means door bolt.
Door bolt?
Yeah, as in close the door, essentially.
So, do you know what that's interesting? Because a lot of the stuff that I was reading was saying it was very much regarded as a defensive formation, what we would call like a park the bus formation nowadays.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's exactly it. So then they'd use a sweeper in Italian football. So it's not quite the same. And as I say, it is a derivative of it and an offset midfield. And an offset forward three over there, which might be slightly more like that. But that a lot of people have said over the years, this was very much a park the bus formation. Now, Hungary sort of made this famous, you know, Puskas from the Puskas Award, this unbelievable 1950s Hungary side, regarded almost as the greatest international side ever. Actually didn't win a World Cup, but got very, very close. They got beaten in the World Cup final by West Germany. There was loads of stuff that went wrong in the game for them. They actually beat West Germany in the group stages 8-3 at one point during that World Cup. It was the only game that they lost in a decade, the World Cup final. Like, that's
devastating,
mentally bad luck, yeah. Isn't it? Like, yeah. So their formation was, again, slightly different. But, as I say, heavily influenced by this. Now, theirs was back in the day. I think it was called the WW formation. So on this one, you can see the W's there and the W's there. Now, that's because back in the day, you used to write the team sheet with the goalkeeper at the top, not the bottom.
Right.
So nowadays, we'd call that an M formation.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of lore around what it's going to be called, Josh, of course. But yeah, so that was the Hungary side from the 50s. Now, I want to talk a little bit about some of the other sides then. Now, first of all, for Arsenal's 1925 side, these positions were slightly different to what we would see today in that for Arsenal, he used three fullbacks, two halfbacks, two inside forwards, a right winger, a left winger and a centre forward. So the use of the three fullbacks was interesting for me.
It's almost like that then, really, isn't it? You got your inside forwards and your wingers.
Which is something that we do nowadays. Mm. We flood the line, don't we, with five bodies.
Yeah.
Now, for Pep Guardiola and his Bayern Munich side, I'll let you talk about this because this one starts off in possession because what happened is basically teams were exploiting it out of possession. So nowadays, this WM formation has been brought back very much as a sort of in-possession thing. So Pep Guardiola for Bayern Munich, I think, yeah, talk us through it.
Yeah, well, when Pep, just called him Pop, Christ.
Hi, Dad.
I wish it was, to be honest with you.
My bald Pop.
Yeah. When Pep got to Germany, he was immediately struck by the level of the counter-attack compared to Spain. Obviously, you've got lots of transition-based stuff going on in Germany. You've got Jürgen Klopp over there and all those kinds of coaches. So straight away, that was kind of on Pep's agenda in terms of dealing with that. So his primary way of doing that was basically occupying the centre, similar to the way Liverpool are at the minute with the 3-2-5 shape in the box in the middle of the park. So the player who was essentially Alexander-Arnold back then was Philipp Lahm, in terms of just being so tactically intelligent, technical, really versatile. And Pep used him as a inverted fullback in a few different ways. I think one of the first ways was, say this is Thomas Muller playing in a three. Muller would do that, Lahm would do that, and you'd have your back three shuffle over like that, essentially. And then you've almost got like a 3-3-4 in kind of a weird attacking shape. But I think the more common way in which he did it, unless I'm mistaken, was basically Lahm doing the same as Alaba on the opposite side. Mm-hmm. Pep was in a weird position where he basically had two inverted fullbacks on each flank who could both do it to a really, really high level. They would tuck inside like that alongside, might have been Xabi Alonso. And then you'd have your attacking bank of five further forward. Just kind of like that. No, not like that. Yeah, like that. And that's kind of how Pep dealt with the transitions in the Bundesliga. You had this kind of safety net in the centre.
Mm-hmm.
And it established, I suppose, one of the main genetic principles of the WM, really, in that...
Five attackers, five defenders.
Exactly, but also in the sense that if you look at the five attackers, you're as wide as you can possibly be. If you look at your five defenders, you're as narrow as you can possibly be. So you make the space small for your opponents and you make it as wide as possible when you're trying to score, essentially.
And then in latter years, Cruz would drop in.
Yeah,
That sort of three and use your fullbacks as your two, of course.
Yeah.
Thomas Tuchel did it in a slightly different way. Thomas Tuchel did it in a 3-4-3 formation. So he'd have these guys, we'll start it like that, and you'd say that was a 3-4-3 sound, no problem. Defensively, what they would do is they would have that sort of five-man back. Let's say, your wing-backs, your Marcus Alonso's, your Reece James's.
Victor Moses.
And what they would do is they would push the forwards. This is Antonio Conte did this as well, actually.
Yeah, that's where I've got Victor Moses from, actually, in a Conte's time.
Yeah, well, they obviously won the league in 2016-17 with that formation. Mm. And so how they would do it is they would pull the fullbacks all the way up, all the way wide, and bring the wingers inside. And that's how they would achieve that sort of WM formation. So there's loads of different sort of ways to do it, which is quite interesting. I'm getting all confused with these counters nowadays, you know.
Again, like what you've just done there with the wing-backs, it resulted again in a bank of five there. It's like, just do it now, there quickly. You've got your bank of five in the final third. You've got your bank of five behind the ball to give you the safety net. So it's kind of different ways to achieve the same goal almost, really, isn't it?
Exactly. And then Manchester City, obviously very similar to us in the 4-3-3 formation. Now, do you remember that year when they had Fabian Delph?
Yeah.
And Delph was doing that?
Yeah.
And that's how they would do it, and they would flood like that.
Yeah.
So you've got De Bruyne going forwards. Nowadays, you've obviously got Gundogan. You'd have their wingers providing that width. And again, exactly what you're saying, and I think the basics of this is right. Five there, five back. So then, I suppose, Josh, for us, Liverpool's 4-3-3 was never really seen as this per se. But in some ways, the basic principles are the same. Yeah. Didn't shape up in the WM, Josh, but it did end up in a 5-v-5 situation. The one we won the league with Trent at right back.
Yeah, well, you had obviously Mo Salah out here, tucking inside. You had Roberto Firmino in the centre, just doing what he always does. You had Sadio Mane tucking inside. And then you wanted another two, essentially. And Klopp, early on, was getting linked with, well, he signed Naby Keita, he signed Oxlade-Chamberlain to potentially do that. But we ended up, just through the makeup of the team and the way things shaped up, with Trent being that player and Robertson being that player. And then you had, basically, there's your safety net. You got Henderson, the workhorse midfield, if you like. Henderson, Fabinho, Wijnaldum, Virgil, and Matip, Gomez, whoever, Lovren. And then there's Liverpool's attacking bank of five there, you know, constructing whatever shape you want. They're probably the two highest players in terms of Mane and Salah. And then you had Trent, Robertson, and Firmino kind of linking the play. But again, it goes back to the bank of five there, bank of five there.
Thanks to Josh and Chris, another wonderful show. Just to let you go, by the way, there's a free version of that deep dive on YouTube and on podcasts each and every week as well. And then there's a second episode over on Red Men Plus. So yeah, like I mentioned at the top of the show, thanks if you're still here listening to me ramble on. But yeah, redmenplus.com. Sign up, yearly club captain, use the code YEAR, get it for £25. Go back and listen or watch to all those shows, plus the entire back catalogue of stuff we've ever done, including all of our documentaries and features. Spoiler alert, we've got a Bobby Firmino docu-series coming in this summer as well. So if you sign up now, you'll also get access to that. Never been a better time to join us. And for £25 a month, a year even, a month would be pretty high. A year, that is an absolute bargain. So yeah, get on over to redmenplus.com, come and join us, and I'll be back next week with another episode of Red Men Weekly. I'll catch you all next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hey, Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.